Welcome to the PR Moment podcast. Produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
On the PR Moment podcast this week, we're talking to Charlotte Mayer, founder and managing director of The Fitting Room. The Fitting Room was originally called PR and Everything in Between, and it was rebranded as The Fitting Room in 2017. It specialises in food and drink, fashion, music and hospitality work. It has revenues of about 1.2 million and employs circa 7 people. Clients include Café Rouge, Sony, Green King and Patchak. Thanks as ever to our PR Moment podcast sponsors, the PRCA. And just to say, we're running a reader offer with Propel Software, where if you register through PR Moment, you get a free trial. So click on the banner on PR Moment just to find out how to take advantage of this offer. Charlotte, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ben.
Now, one of the things I loved when we spoke before, it was kind of a cool story, was that let me get this number right. You started off at £17.22. And that's when you started the business. So go on, just talk me through, which presumably was a fairly tough moment in your life when you didn't have a great deal of dollar, and you decided to start a business from that moment. So just talk me through what happened.
Yeah, I had my day job, and then I had several side hustles. So I wanted to get into the music industry. So I was working with lots of pop groups. They were going on tour with people like JLS and the Saturdays. So I was kind of navigating my way through music and shows happening at Wembley and whatnot and doing tours. And actually, originally, when I started, I wanted us to be an entertainment agency. I had come from a background of doing sales and events. And I had worked with several celebrities delivering events for them. And I thought, oh, this might be for me. But then I also had this burning desire to work in PR. And I thought, oh, you know, we could start a team of celebrity publicists. And that's where it was sort of born. I didn't have a real proper background in PR, definitely not in agency world. And one day I just woke up and thought, I'm going to start a business today. And I called my dad and he said, what's the worst that can happen? You get a bit of debt and you move home. And that's kind of my parents all over. They are those people that say, just jump, darling, just jump. So I did just jump and I went to see my boss at the time. And I said, I'm thinking of starting my own agency. And he said, okay, cool. Well, why don't we turn your job into a retainer? So you've got your first client. And you can start the business from our offices in Shoreditch and you can keep your laptops. We can keep those costs down. And I said, oh, thank you. That's bloody good because I've literally got 17 quid in my account as of today. And I was just going to run with it and kind of see where life takes me.
That's a really nice thing for the employer to do, isn't it? Brilliant. What a nice person.
Yeah, they're incredible.
Are you still in contact with them now?
Yeah. When we left, so we represented them up until they were acquired a couple of years ago. We did that comms still. So yeah,
right. That's really cool. I think hearing you talk there resonated with me. I think when I launched PR Moment, the first thing I did was ring my dad. That's quite interesting. It might be one of those nice themes for entrepreneurs. Did you ring a parent when you had that moment? And really? A lot of them will say yes. And you've now got revenues of what, just over a million? So that's kind of a cool story, isn't it? I mean, you launched the original business, PR and Everything in Between, what, 8 years or so back. So it's, you know, if you've taken 8 years to sort of get there, but I get the feeling since you've rebranded as The Fitting Room in what, 2017, that's when you've really got some momentum. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so with PR and Everything in Between, I did not have a Scooby what I was doing. I had read a book and I'm very stubborn, as my parents would say, and I had just gone off and set up this agency. And, you know, we were this very ballsy group of girls. And we just didn't care. I think I was 27. I was like, well, I had no money when I started. I'll never be scared of not having any money. Let's go for it. And, you know, we won the contract for Cliff Richard in our first year to do his Reeling the Rock in UK tour. And we tweeted about it one day from our account. And we ended up talking to this brilliant human, Jonathan, who owns the Breakfast Club, Cat in London. And he said, And I always tell the story. He said, oh, my mum and my auntie Janet love Cliff. And we said, we'll give you two tickets if you give us a meeting. And that kind of snowballed into winning them. And that's where we sort of had this shift from wanting to do celebrity, ending up sort of doing a bit of a sidestep into hospitality. And when I was in my events days, we had done a lot of work for the events agency that I worked for Late Night London, Nova's Leisure. So we booked lots of events into Tiger and everything else. And one of their team approached me about going in-house and looking after their comms. And I said, no, I'm going to start my own agency, la, la, la. And then they said, well, do you want to come in and pitch for what would have been your job? So again, had never done a pitch before and was like, okay, we got this. And Googled how you do pitches and everything else, put my ideas in, reached out to another small PR agency and said, we're going into this pitch, would love you to be involved. And we can work out the details afterwards, but let's see how we can help each other. And we went in and we won Novus Late Night London. And that was our first, the consumer contract was a $5,000 a month retainer. So at that point I was like, yes, I can pay bills and I haven't got to worry for a minute. So that's kind of how it got started. But yeah, we were this real fearless, ballsy bunch.
Yeah. It's cool, isn't it? Yeah, it does take me back. That period in your career when you're starting a business, when you have nothing to lose, you're absolutely lethal, aren't you, at that point? You take risks for obvious reasons that completely subconsciously later on you don't take.
Yeah, completely. Those were the best. We just had the most fun. We really did have the most fun. And I was in my 20s and my friends were like, how are you living this life? And I was like, I don't know, but I don't want to get off this ride, so we're just going to keep doing it. So when we got to 2017, I think I was a bit tired. My accountant said to me, you really need to move out of your office in Shoreditch because you're spending far too much money having fun after work, and being in Hoxton Square was not good for the bank account. So when we decided to rebrand, I had spent a lot of time looking at agencies in the US and a lot of time thinking about what was next. Sort of, I didn't like this idea of going into PR pitches and people saying, oh, you know, your KPI is 10 cuttings. And I was like, but what if that 10 cuttings doesn't do anything to your bottom line? What if we don't actually shift any units by working to that metric? I don't understand it. So I started looking at human behavior in terms of how people buy and how people consume. And when we were PR and everything in between, the idea was that PR was at the heart of the business and the everything in between represented social media, film, brand strategy, all of those other routes to market to build a fan base and to get sales. And it wasn't landing because people were just seeing the word PR and that's what they wanted to talk about. So I wanted to take a step away from that and I really wanted to evolve the proposition in a very, very specific way. And it was kind of creative communication meets ad agency mindset from the US. And that's what I kind of looked at. I got really obsessive about things like DigiDay, Adweek, Ad Age, all of those magazines, like studying them kind of religiously and then making sure that I was reading every white paper and report out there on consumer behavior and what consumers wanted in terms of how they wanted to buy, how they wanted information to be presented to them. And that's where I had this moment where I spent about 3 weeks trying to come up with a new name. And that's where this sort of shift happened with the business.
It's a cool name. It works, isn't it? Just talk us through the was it one of those that just came to you? Now that's it. How did it work out?
Yeah, I wanted something that could be abbreviated. So a lot of people just call us TFR because I just thought we could have more fun with the branding. And I wanted it to represent something and I didn't want it to be my name. A few people kept saying my name. And I was like, if I call it my name, the value, if I ever want to sell it, it's just harder once I step out of the business. So the idea of the fitting room was brands, businesses, people, they step into this space and we as a business strip them down bare and then redress them with a tailored fit, which basically is what they need to solve the business challenges that they have. So it was all about this bespokeness because, again, when we were PR and everything in between, when we were going in to pitch for things, a lot of the time when we were winning these things against some of the big boys, actually, the client was saying, oh, we just got the impression that they had, it was the same pitch that they had given to everybody. And we were doing new pitches like every single time, every single piece of creative was bespoke to them, and that's definitely slowed down our growth. But I have OCD about levels of perfection. So that was where that was sort of born of. And we just, again, we looked at a lot of the agency names in the US, and we just thought, actually, that's a bit of a vibe. And that name allows us, it's universal. We could take that to Paris. We could take that to New York. We could take that to Tokyo. And the name would still mean the same thing, because a fitting room is fundamentally universal.
Yeah. No, that's a good, nice idea. I guess it has retail connotations, doesn't it? But you've kind of broken out from them already. So, yeah, well done. Now, you talked a bit there. Well, two elements of that, which you just talked about a bit, and it might be the same answer, actually, now I think about it. I'm intrigued by this US inspiration as opposed to London, because that's where you're a London girl, I think, and that's where you grew up. So why didn't you go, okay, right, I'm going to copy some London firms and connect it? Well, go on, yeah, that's the first bit. Well, how did that, I get the logic, I mean, it's great now it's happened, but what made you take that step?
I think, and I probably didn't think about this until the last few months when we were really tightening up the proposition, but I think that for me, not coming from a UK agency, looking at them, it always felt a little bit cliquey. And reading a lot of the publications, it felt like people kind of moved away around in them in the same way. And I think as well, being honest, and this isn't about a black and white thing, but when I looked at them, I never saw anybody that looked like me. So I think probably in my subconscious, in America, I look at the trends. I'm the queen of hip hop. Anything to do with Puffy, Jay-Z, all of that, that is my vibe. And, you know, then when you start to unpack Diddy and you see that he had this marketing agency, when you look at Jay-Z and what he built with Roc Nation, when you start to break that down, that's where I was naturally drawn to, and then started to expand out from those agencies to other agencies and looking at places that drive the cool, that drive the trends. If you think about things from places like Atlanta that have really come through, that previously were behind places like LA. And I definitely watched too many popular culture movies like The Devil Wears Prada, thinking that that was going to be my life in the big city of New York.
Right. So that, yeah, that's interesting, because that does tally into what everybody says, is that all of us need role models, don't we? And it seems to me, without getting too Freudian about this, you found a role model on the other side of the Atlantic, because there weren't those agency role models in, or you weren't able to find them at the time in London, which is a bit sad, actually.
And I just to caveat that, all of my former bosses, all the people that have led me previously, have all been white men, which is why when people sort of go for this, oh, you know, they're this, that, I'm like, they're actually not, because the people that helped me were those exact people that the media and, you know, people are against and saying we need more diversity. But actually, I was, my career and my help through all my drive and everything else, the moments and the breaks that I got and the introductions did come from that set. I just also needed... Yes. Something else as well, you know, going back to that saying, you cannot be what you cannot see, and pulling on that, I think that's really important. But as I said to you earlier on in the week, you know, diversity and inclusion, I think it's just not my bag. I think it's spoken about too much. I think hire the right people for the right roles, make sure you put the roles where everybody can see them, and you follow the decent side of being a human being. I don't think it's as deep as it's being made out to be, but I know that's my slightly outspoken opinion.
Well, let's come on to that in a minute, but because I just want to talk about this vibe. You mentioned it a few times already today, and it's one of those words that can mean so many different things to different people in a different context, frankly. So you seem to use it a lot when you're talking about the type of work that you do. So just give us a flavour of, I suppose, your work and therefore the vibe, or maybe the other way around, yeah.
Yeah, for me, the vibe is a representation of the culture. So people, firstly, culture is a very overused word now, I think, by everybody. But for us, our tagline is culture comes first. And this is about every experience that we create and every story that we tell is tailored to a community that is driven by different types of culture. So our vibe, our energy, again, and this comes back to the US piece, whenever we look at these parties and these activations and everything in the US, they are just a whole different level of experience, guests, if you look at their PR, gifting, everything is so extra. And that is the American vibe. And the fundamentals of that are driven by Black hip hop culture. You know, if you think about what Diddy did for Ciroc when he took his shares of when they went from being a reasonably known vodka brand to being the leaders of culture now across the US. I actually posted this morning on my LinkedIn about Steve Stoop, who wrote the book, The Tanning of America, where he talks about the tanning effect and how essentially hip hop culture drives popular culture that sets the trends that influences what and how people buy. So that when we talk about the vibe, it's kind of that, it's kind of the extraness. It's the fun, it's the authenticity, it's the right people at the table. It's like proper storytelling that goes deep into the heartland of what that group of people that you're trying to attract are naturally affiliated to.
Okay. And just on the story of the business, it's, as you sort of mentioned, it's obviously taken off in the last 18 months or so. Is that right? Because it was,
yeah, I would say.
Okay, but then it's gone whoosh, is it?
Yeah, when we rebranded in 2017, I mean, if I thought I didn't know what I was doing running a PR agency when I started, running 360, where you've got multiple disciplines going into the channels that you're delivering for clients, that was a real on the job shit. Like, how are we doing this moment? So we definitely took a year to find our feet, because as soon as we rebranded, there was a shift in work. You know, our first project after the rebrand was a double decker ice cream tour across the UK. Our next big campaign was teaming up award-winning producer Naughty Boy with Shake Shack to launch a burger. It was flying to New York to work with our culinary director. It was closing Shake Shack Leicester Square to throw a big party for 300 people. So we sort of had to, we learn on the job, really. I swap my nights out for, well, I haven't, don't think I've had big nights out in ages, but for reading and for studying and for looking at other things, looking at case studies, understanding more and more deliverables, understanding the metrics of success. Because again, I wasn't, and I haven't been a part of Agency Club UK. So you sort of learn as you go. And we have another rule in our business, and it's just something that I live by, you know, lift as you climb. So we really do try and help other young women, irrespective of color, religion, whatever, who are trying to come through and do things differently. Because I know I wasn't necessarily aware of it, because I was raised by my parents, did a very good job. We were raised in a home county, so we were always the only Black kids, and we were at grammar school, so it was a very different upbringing. But those things that were around us when we were younger gave us the confidence to walk into any rooms. I don't get nervous going into an exec meeting or presenting to CEOs, because the foundation had already been set in high school, where my mother was making me speak every summer soiree and and everything else. So it was a completely different thing for me.
And you're not a PR firm, are you? Go on, I try to ask you this a few times. You're 360, you give all these different...
Yeah, so this is why we're doing our proposition tidy up at the moment, because we're trying to not be everything to everyone, because I came from such a diverse background in skill sets I picked up. Like, I fundamentally love sales, but not sales in like hard sales. Sales is in just becoming buddies with everybody, and then work and revenue is generated from those relationships. So we myself and my creative leader at the moment, we're breaking it down at the moment, but we're somewhere between 360 integrated comms, brand communications, and brand marketing. But if you ask me in 3 weeks, I'll be able to give you a definitive answer.
I'm not going to get involved in that debate, but isn't there some cool tale you didn't have a website till May?
Yeah, shit, yeah.
In November,
yeah. I mean, now we're ripping that one up to do a new one to align with what the revised vision is. We've always had a holding page, and I'm not really sure why. Again, all of our work, pretty much 95% of it, has been referral, so there was never that need for it, because we were just introduced to people and people just said, we've got a problem, and someone would say, speak to Charlotte, and we would go in and work with them. And as well, as I think I said to you the other day, once we won Late Night London back in the day, pretty much every person who was in the marketing team at that time who left took us with them. So with some of our clients, we've been with them through five different brands. So we never kind of needed it. And we started to need it the last year because we started to be invited to tenders. And I said to my team, like, shit, we've got an adult now. Like, we got to be less startup, keep our get shit done mindset. But we need to tally that with if where we want to get to, their expectation is we have these things in the business. That's what we need to start building in. But again, it's a self-taught business. There's no big investors. There's none of that. So it is a learn as you go.
I mean, hearing you talk, you seem to have it all pre-nailed. I mean, it's amazing. you know what I mean there? Because you haven't had an agency background. I don't mean to sound passionate, but you're still quite young. Well, how did you... Have you just been, is it all that late night reading? Is that what's done it?
Yeah. Studying the craft, studying people that I want to be like. I'm really big on mirroring that. So again, a lot of the women in the US that I look to and the men, the way that they've navigated through their careers, I just started plotting out. Like, I have a number of books where I've scribbled, like, she went into this and then she went into this. And I also think that I've been really fortunate in the sense that, again, excuse my French, we have a line, and I always say it to my guys, it's fuck the fear. The worst that is going to happen is that someone's going to say no to you. I've had a couple of mentors along the way that has been really great. And actually, the reason that we're talking today is because somebody from big agency world that is very known had a call with me a couple of weeks ago, and he said, why are you not in the press? He said, I'd heard a bit about you. I'd seen some of the campaigns that you'd done, but you should probably be putting yourself out there. And he was quite strong with me on it. But it just, yeah, I think that people overthink these things. And I think as well, for me, if you have nothing to lose, you just go for it. And I think that was our response to COVID. It was, you know, the accountant, do we have enough cash reserves? How long can we last? Yep, you've got this, this, and this. Cool, fine. So no one's jobs are at risk. No, absolutely not. Fine, let's just crack on then. And that just removed it. And I, again, learned the hard lessons of having a bit too much fun in the first few years, that my accountant the last 3 years was like, cash is king, cash is king, save. And that's what we had done that meant that we could still carry on living with that mindset. And actually this window of craziness has definitely given us a time to reset. And in normal world, I would have never have written to you. I would have been one campaign to the next campaign, you know, not really looking up. So yeah, study, observe the greatest who have done it before you. And also because as I said to you at the beginning, nobody really looked like me. I got this thing into my head about laying my own table. So for example, in September 2019, I decided to launch my own brunch. So it's called It's Time. And it was a brunch for marketing directors, heads of marketing. We started with women in hospitality. We threw this big brunch at Al's restaurant in West London. And what was really interesting then, when I was looking at the invites list, I couldn't find other Black people to invite. I was the only Black person there. So that's why I say, like, I get the challenges, and I did a lot of research. But that's it as well. Like, do your own thing. Last year for our Christmas party, we hired a hall through our roller disco. We brought in DJ Luck and MC Neat, Sweet Female Attitude, 200 people, clients, suppliers, everybody. Like, that's our vibe. Domino's pizza delivered to it. It was, you know, DJs from Box Park and whatnot. It was popping. Like, that's who we are. And we've got to grow a little bit away from that, but those are the fundamentals. You know, life is short, you know, live it.
Yeah, no, nice touch. Now, just on the hospitality, it was kind of the root of the business, but you know what I mean? It was a decent chunk of clients you had. That's presumably you had a tough time the last 6 months.
Yeah. And when we went into, we shut the office before we actually went into lockdown because we were getting ready to launch a big new venue, and the CEO said, I think we've got to pull this. And I had just been in New York for the Adweek Challenger Brand Summit, and I had landed back, and my first meeting was at Hennessy. And I went there, there was no handshaking, there was sanitizer everywhere, we had to sit apart, and I was like, oh shit, this is real, what's about to hit. We were very lucky. As I said, we've been with a number of our clients through different phases of their careers and life cycles. And actually, everybody that could paid as quickly as they could. Everybody that couldn't was very honest and got things onto payment terms. And we just started to step away. And I said to my creative lead, we fell into kind of being this business to a degree. We had a plan. That plan was built around delivering excellence. But we had the opportunity to here to flip this and make it the direction that we want to be. So if we relook at that, what have we got to do? What's the foundations that we've got to go into that? And it, I was like, don't worry about money. We can ride this out. We've got to be careful, but we can ride this out because we do still, not every client stopped as well. It was definitely a learning. But as I said to you at the beginning, my thing was, if you started with nothing, as long as you can look after your people, I'm not afraid to go back to zero. I'm not afraid to get on the phone and do cold calling. I'm not afraid to send cold emails again. As I said, there was no club. I didn't leave a big agency and then take five clients with me, have a business partner that could look after the people while I looked after the sales. It was just make this work if you want to get to this point.
As a black woman running her own firm, is there an expectation you're going to become a role model? Do you feel that pressure?
I'm very aware. I get young women reach out to me on LinkedIn, on Instagram, and I always try and get back to everybody. I always try and book them in for a call or, you know, whatever they need. And I think when I started it, I didn't think about it like that. And up until the last sort of 18 months, when our campaigns became bigger and people started to pay more attention to them, it hadn't really been a thing about me being black. Like, I didn't even have LinkedIn. Like, it was there. And then one of my friends said, we wanted to say well done to you on LinkedIn for the campaign that you delivered, but you didn't have a company page or anything. And I was like, oh, okay. Because I think in my subconscious, as I said to you the other day, like, there was this head down, hit a million, and then you've got a seat at the table and you can have a conversation. But then when I started looking left and right, I was like, there are people who are one man bands that have got real voices in the industry, and that, you know, they've built their business based on lifestyle choices for themselves. But for me, again, I probably put a lot of the pressure on myself because I was looking at the US side going big, 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 big. But I'm acutely aware that I am very different and a lot of, and quite outspoken with that difference. I think that I try and let the work speak for itself, because I think the other thing with being presumed to be a black role model is it's so easy for brands to go, oh, you know, call that agency, it's led by a black person, they can come in and work on our D&I, or they can look at our urban division, or they can do this. And what I've worked really hard to do over the last few years is keep us straight down the middle. We just create cool shit that people want. It's not about the color of your skin. It's just about culture comes first. What is influencing the culture that you want to attract? That's what we build a campaign for. And everyone, I'm black, everyone's going to see that I'm black when, as soon as they look at me. And quite often they're like, oh, she's really posh for a black person. I'm like, let's raise the home counties. I went to grammar school. Not everything is what you read and see on the news. Like, you know, some of us are just trying to crack on. So
it's interesting though. I mean, that whole role model thing is so important, isn't it? And, you know, we're all, in a way, we're all role models. We might be bad role models, but you know what I mean? We're all role models to somebody. But it's not something you necessarily ask for, is it?
No.
Because I'm a middle-aged white guy, you know, there's enough of me as role models, you know what I mean? So that doesn't, there's no pressure for me to be a role model. But as a successful black woman, there is more of that. And I just wonder whether that's fair, whether that's something you, or do you just want to get on with running your own business? I'm not sure you have a choice. I'm just intrigued.
I think the thing though, the journey to this point has been based on stubbornness, resilience, and never ending belief that something can be better. And I think if you're living by those fundamentals in life, you are going to get to a point and people are going to look to you. It's not something that I would ever say, but it is something that I would always try and behave like. But that doesn't mean that I don't make any less mistakes. I've made a huge amount of mistakes. And I always say, fail fast and get up and go again. And I've probably made lots more mistakes because there wasn't kind of this, as I said, this club around me that told me what to do. So I was probably even more exposed. And then people saw my skin color and they made their assumptions. You kind of got to get over it and crack on. But yeah, the black women in the US that I look to, and white women, they probably didn't set out to be role models, but they all set out with a certain mindset that meant that if they achieved what they wanted, they were naturally going to become those, especially if they were of a minority.
For all of us, I think when you when you have an idea and you want to go and do something in life, you tend to ask people, don't you? And there's always, people always critique ideas, and by that process, normally it ends up people telling you why you shouldn't do something, if you see what I mean. So I just had this slight moment hearing you talk there, but maybe one of the keys to your success was that you didn't have those people telling you not to do stuff, and you just went for it. Because I think when I look back on my career, the times when I've either had to go for it, or you know, that choice is taken away from you, is when you actually make some really good decisions. The decisions by committee are normally not great ones, it seems to me, in that sort of context.
Yeah, definitely. Now with social media and podcasts and everything, there are so many brilliant people that you can have access to learn from as well, that I don't know if you necessarily need that club in the same way that you did, unless you need funds. But again, I was never bothered about the money. Like when we hit the sales target, the revenue of last year, I was like, oh shit, because all we had been focused on was delivering excellence. That was it. There was no other thing in that. I had a rough number of, if we do this, we're gonna have a good time in 2020, hello COVID, but it wasn't based in that way. And that's the transition that we've got to start doing when I talk about adulting a bit more, because we've proven ourselves in terms of the work and everything else, but we've got other areas that I've got to improve the business to get to the next level.
There's lots of buzzwords I'm gonna write down after this podcast, and adulting is definitely one of them. I like that.
No one wants to do it. We all think we want to be older, and then it hits us, it's like, nope.
Now, one of the lines I really liked when we talked in the pre-show chat was that you want to be who you needed when you were younger, which is a really nice way of putting it. Just talk me through what you mean by that.
I think that comes back to, actually, I've got a really good example of that. This week I gave a comment to Campaign Magazine for an article they were writing, and I posted it on my LinkedIn yesterday, and I said to my younger brother, I can't remember the last time I saw a Black expert on LinkedIn talking about some of their beliefs around work that wasn't based on diversity and inclusion. And I said, I genuinely can't think of one. And I said it to my team, and my team is very mixed group of people. And they were like, yeah, no, you're actually right. And when we did a campaign for Black History Month that was a TFR campaign called Be the Magic, and it was celebrating Black women in business, Black women in sport, Black women who have achieved things by channeling Black girl magic. And one of my team, who is also Black, she wrote on Instagram saying, I didn't know that I could be this person until I started working for Charlotte. I didn't know that I could put myself out there in this very smart and intelligent way that wasn't about looking like how Instagram wanted me to look. I could actually have a voice of authority. And that was about 3 weeks ago. And it was a real moment for me. And again, when we went into lockdown, the second part of our It's Time, we host a 3-day virtual classroom. We reached out to the Benito Project, which is a PR agency in New York run by a brilliant young woman called Danielle. And she represents, she would say, Black, brown and people of color, which is a very Americanized. And I said to her, I was like, I really love the way that you bring everybody to the table. We want to bring every shade of woman and being to the table. Let's do this 3-day thing. And we pulled in women from LA, Seattle, London, Paris, like you name it. And they did this panel, and we had 400 people sign up. You know, TFR picked up the bill for it because we just wanted to do something good. Danielle hosted one session. We co-hosted a session together. And then I hosted one on my own. And when I did that, I didn't realize how many young women were going to write to me on Instagram to say, thank you for doing that. And actually, when we came out of that, I said to Bonnie, my creative lead, like, we're living our values now. We're setting down the foundations. We're not shouting about me being Black. We're not shouting about any of that noise. We are just fundamentally getting up every day and making choices that show other women, especially young women, that they can be whatever they want to be. It's going to be harder in certain circumstances, for sure. But we need to, because Bonnie is Asian Australian as well, my number two. And my younger brother, AJ, he's worked for me for 4.5 years. He's a young Black man. So when you look at the three of us, it kind of throws people, because we are the people that lead the business. And we are examples to those people. And I didn't, you know, I had women writing to me from across the globe that have signed up to join these panels saying, oh my God. And it, to me, it just wasn't that deep, because I was just doing my job as a marketeer, talking to great people about marketing. And we just made damn sure that we gave a great group of people a seat at the table. That was really important to me. And I never saw that when I was younger. And anything I did see like that, again, it came from America and was normally something to do with hip hop, sport, music or entertainment.
Yeah, it's well done. It's great. It's really impressive and important work that you're doing with that. Now, when we spoke before, you mentioned a few terms you didn't like, which just got me thinking and surprised me a little bit as well. You don't like the term BAME. Just talk us through why that is.
Well, what does it mean?
Well,
it's a word to group different people. Yeah. Into one word that makes other people feel a bit more comfortable. I am black, but fundamentally I'm just a woman. It doesn't mean anything more than that. And I think that everyone's got obsessed with this word BAME, and actually it dilutes all the races that sit in there. I mean, if you're a minority and you're just the M in that word, you don't even actually get like where you're from. Your heritage and your culture is completely killed because you're just the M. You're just even grouped with an even broader audience. And I also just don't feel the need for it. The message should just be hire the right people for the right roles and make sure you put that message out as far and wide as you can. Understand the cultural differences between different people, understand the economical differences across the landscape, even more so in a COVID world where we know minorities, again, grouping, have been hit the hardest. Understand that there was the biggest civil rights movement this year. So certain black people are a little bit, you know, jaded. Hello, the election that's been going for days. You know, be mindful of those things. But that doesn't mean you have to shout diversity and inclusion. That just means you have to be a decent person. I think BAME, the term, actually dilutes the people that sit within that group.
There's a few things there, and I'm not challenging any of that. I don't disagree with any of that, but so in essence, we just, if we need to describe the color of our skin, we're black, we're white, we're Asian, etc. in a fairly simplistic way, fine. Now on the, when it comes to hiring, because that's PR's got a problem with diversity. I think most professions have, most sectors have, in different ways and all the rest of it. But how do we're currently trying to improve the diversity of public relations or our own businesses, our own organizations, etc. And one of the ways to do that, I guess, is to be more is to make sure that we are recruiting from those diverse groups. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is don't worry about any of that, or is it? Just recruit the best person for the job.
Yes and no. So I think recruiting the best person for the job is your responsibility to make sure those ads and that outreach goes to everybody. So you touch everybody. I think it is the recruiter or the people in culture, whomever's doing the drive, needs to understand the challenges within different groups of people, economically, socially, all of those impacts. But I also just think for me, and I guess I might just upset a few people with this, I never want to be sat at the table or invited to the table because I'm black. That is a surefire way to piss me off. I want to be sat at the table because I earned my spot there and I'm the best. Now, I understand that I can say that with certain levels of privilege that I had from being raised in a white area that gave me a certain mindset. So I understand the challenges within that on the other side of that. But I also just think this sometimes what feels like a constant division and having to say it when it's actually just like we pulled together a really great lineup. And in you have to be mindful that that lineup does need to include a range of people. But if you've genuinely got the best lineup, chances are you have got people from a minority background sat there that have had different experiences and can tell different stories and open up the conversation further. And that was the point of why we did our 3-day classroom. Was it wasn't that anybody that was white wasn't included. It was probably half and half because we just wanted a really great table. And I think that now, you know, again, in certain professions, everything is now focused on getting a black person into a diversity and inclusion role. And that in itself is a problem because actually Black people are incredibly creative for a number of reasons, normally from the social economic background that they've come from. If you take a look at the hip hop artists, most of them are from the Bronx, the projects. They had nothing, but they have incredible resilience to keep going. They've built multi-million pound empires. And I think that we've got a little bit distracted. And, you know, I stayed quiet during the Black Lives Matter movement in the summer because I just thought there's a lot of people jumping on this bandwagon that don't mean what they're saying. And come September, this will have been done. And it's kind of been proven. A lot of people have quietened down on it. And I also, again, controversial, do wonder if it's as much as a priority to people as they say it is. You know, it's competitive out there, even more competitive now post-COVID. Are people actively trying to have more people wanting those jobs sat at the table? I think there's a bigger thing in it than what people are saying.
Okay. Now, another term you don't like is urban. What's wrong with urban?
Oh, gosh. Urban, if you mean urban in the sense of what urban actually is in terms of geographically of where you live. But when you start grouping people into, you know, for example, in hospitality, if a lot of Black people go to a venue and there's a problem, I will sit in an exec meeting and they will say there was a real urban crowd there. And they mean a Black crowd. But they also want to take the cool of the Black and of the culture, which is why they have certain DJs and certain branding and that edginess. But that's not urban. I think it's been a really overused word to describe people in quite a negative way without just saying it.
We're almost out of time, so I just want to give you your plans for the fitting room. You want to go international. Is that sort of,
yeah,
that seems to be the way you're thinking of taking it.
Yeah, definitely. I think I've still got a fair few L's to take over the next few years before we get there. But that's the vision. And I think at the moment as well, you know, in a post-COVID world, we're just tidying up the business. We're just tightening up on the proposition and what we do and why you would bring us into a room. And actually, I've been talking to more agency people since COVID, which I hadn't done before. And again, I think because people have seen bits of our work, they've been more open to having conversations. I just want to learn and I just want to grow. But we want excellence in everything that we do. So that's going to mean a slower growth for sure.
Okay. Why is that true? Why would you say that? I would have thought if you do excellence in everything you do, you could grow really quickly. But
I think the being a smaller agency, excellence normally means that my time is spent on things as well with the team, probably more so than them focusing on the growth because there isn't a business partner. There isn't somebody else to pick up one part.
So it's those key stages, I suppose, isn't it? Which I've probably done a podcast on at some point of that agency growth. You know what I mean? Where you get to, I forget now, but the rule of three, I think it was, wasn't it? You've at 3, 10 and 30 or something along those lines. I can't quite remember now, but you have to, you know, one of those you need an accountant, another one you need an HR person, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then because you can't do everything is kind of what you're saying with that.
Yeah.
You're launching a podcast, which I'm not sure that's right, is it?
I recorded
podcast.
Yeah, so it's called 1722, which just felt appropriate.
Yeah.
I've recorded the first few episodes, just haven't had a minute to put them out. So I think we're launching in 2 weeks. The podcast takes many different shapes. The first interview is with Nick Telson. Nick was the founder of Design My Night, that everyone is very well versed in. And it's his story of how he built and how he sold it. And we have a really good, honest chat about business. So it's more broad than being anything to do with comms. Different people, we talk about culture, we talk about influences in terms of trends and what we think is going to come next. But with Nick, we focused on growth. And then we've got a couple of females that we're talking about being VC investors as well. Again, coming back to that thing of you cannot be what you cannot see and being the person you wanted. If we want to get more women into financials, we need to show them that you don't have to be a certain way to do that. So we've got some quite interesting characters that I had to work really hard to find to come on and talk about numbers, growth, and investment in different rounds, different stages of investment.
Charlotte May, founder and MD at The Fitting Room, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the PR Moment podcast, produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
If you'd enjoyed the show, please do review us on iTunes and give us a decent rating.